Chapter 19. As the miles fell away behind us, I was conscious of a lightening of my spirits. I had spent the better part of the morning packing up my things and heaping metaphorical ashes upon my head. My silence had allowed Harry to abscond with the diamond, an eventuality I ought to have foreseen, given my familiarity with the man and his character, or lack of it. Furthermore, upon reflecting on the appearance of the spectral sphere of light, I had at first wondered if it might have been Harry, roaming the moor in pursuit of some dastardly purpose of his own. Of course, this was impossible, as I had seen him, with my own eyes, emerge from the house with Stoker, where they had been engaged in a spirited game of billiards. But I had not inquired deeply of Stoker as to whether Harry might have absented himself from the game for any period of time. Any gentleman might, I reasoned, withdraw pleading the urges of nature. It would be a simple matter to slip out of the house and venture out onto the moor, but for what purpose? To meet with a confederate. I sat forwards on my seat in excitement. Surely this was the likeliest explanation. The moorland might provide inspiration for tales of supernatural conjurations, but as a scientist, I must always employ logic first when unravelling such a puzzle. And since any criminous activity was within Harry Spenlove's purview, I reasoned, conspiracy might dwell there as well. Perhaps he had stolen the jewel and spirited it out to the moor, delivering it quickly to a partner in crime, a clever precaution in case the house was searched for the missing diamond. With a bit of luck and excellent timing, he might well have managed it, and would have got away entirely undetected, were it not for Anjali's untimely desire for a cigarette. But why then disappear? I wondered. If he had successfully purloined the gem and passed it to a fellow thief, why leave? And why bother with the intricacies of handing it off to another if he meant to disappear at the same time? I puzzled over the question for a long while, until it finally struck me that I did not have to know, and was, in fact, likely never to do so. My gaze fell then upon Stoker, settled in the seat opposite. His brow was furrowed as he studied his newspaper, but he glanced up, catching my gaze with a look that seemed to pierce my very soul. Guilt at the lies of omission I had committed rose within me, choking me. This was the chance to tell him the truth. I opened my mouth, but before I could speak, and without preamble, he moved forward suddenly, covering the distance between our seats, touching his mouth to mine. It was, as ever, spark to a powder keg. I put my arms about his neck as I fell into the kiss, which encompassed some duration and considerable enthusiasm. When he pulled back, we were both flushed and a little untidy. "Whatever brought that on?" I asked, with a lightness I did not feel. He smiled, his gaze intent.
"Perhaps I am simply grateful."
"Grateful?" I searched the floor for a missing hairpin and thrust it into place. He took my hand and began to speak.
"After Caroline, after all that happened in the Amazon," he said,
invoking the name of the former wife who had left him for dead,
"I was so mired in misery that I could not see my way. Days, weeks, months bled into one another. I cannot recall them. Not a single moment stands out in my memory as different from the rest. It was an endless twilight. Nothing seemed to matter. Until the day you burst into my workrooms and turned my life entirely upside down."
"Stoker," I said, but he laid a finger upon my lips.
"Let me finish. You madden me. You distract me. You enrage me. I cannot think of any person of my acquaintance who has so often and so thoroughly driven me to the brink of endurance. And yet you saved me. Whatever that melancholy state, it has been banished. And I know it is, because I wake every day knowing that you are there.
I looked into his eyes. I knew then I could never tell him the truth. To explain Harry's true identity would be to take a sledgehammer to his happiness, and I simply could not bring myself to inflict such pain upon this man whom I loved as fiercely as I had ever loved anything in my life. When we arrived back in London, it was to a predictably chaotic environment. Courtesy of the Easter holidays, the children were home. Lady Cordelia, distracted by the maternal joys of having her own child to tend, albeit in the guise of a foundling left in her care, let them run positively wild. And for all his fondness, Lord Rosmoren was never an attentive parent. Being opportunistic by nature, as all children are, the younger Rosmorens had been left to their own devices. The eldest, Viscount Launceston, heir to the title, was contentedly teaching himself Greek with an eye to excavating antiquities in the Peloponnese. Apart from the odd bit of digging in the herbaceous borders to perfect his field techniques, he troubled no one. His sister, Lady Juno, was also of a scientific bent, although her experiments in chemistry resulted in assorted repellent odours and the odd explosion, which the rest of the family accepted as all in a day's work. The rest of them were variously involved in shipbuilding, arboreal management, photography, stage illusions, and Egyptology. This meant that no matter where one ventured on the estate, there was bound to be a child constructing a yacht, up a tree, developing photographic plates, sawing a sibling in half, or attempting to mummify a rat thoughtfully provided by one of Cook's cats. These were all acceptable and even laudable endeavours, being undertaken in the pursuit of knowledge. One might quibble about the value of mastering the tricks of stagecraft, but putting this point to the child in question resulted in a lengthy lecture regarding the intricacies of light theory and something to do with prisms. I endured the conversation for a quarter of an hour before reeling away for the revivifying consolation of strong drink. But the most impetuous and precocious of his lordship's children was the youngest, Lady Rose. Even now I cannot write those two words without a shudder. To pronounce the name Lady Rose is to conjure an image of feminine delicacy and refinement, but there was no more savage and ruthless creature upon the earth. I would, with delight, welcome 1,000 eruptions of Krakatoa before enduring a minute longer than necessary in her company. She has, from the first moment of our acquaintance, made it her mission to thwart me. I have found my bedsheets soaked with ink, my hair tonic replaced with treacle, the toes of my shoes stuffed with pins. It is not in my temperament to permit such treatment to pass unremarked upon, but Lady Rose has a decided advantage over me. Youth. It is unseemly for a grown woman to embark upon a war of wills with a child of 11, but I frequently daydreamed with real pleasure of hoisting her to the top of the tallest monkey puzzle tree by her petticoats, or feeding her a tart laced with syrup of ipecacuanha. The casual reader may wonder why Lady Rose took a position of instantaneous and implacable hatred towards me, but the reason is quite simple. Stoker. Lady Rose had, from the cradle, entertained a fiendish adoration of the man, fueled by his generosity with sweets and his willingness to let her play with the more outlandish supplies in his workshop. More than once I had come upon them, heads bent near, as Stoker explained the proper way to fit a glass eyeball. She had developed a genuine and impressive enthusiasm for natural history, with a particular gift for bones. The child could take one look at a long bone and pronounce its genus and species. Her father was content to indulge her until she ordered a copy of all 14 volumes of Bertrand's Mammalia at astonishing expense and charged it to his account at Hatchard's. By way of punishment, he suspended her pocket money, which led her to a few fairly outlandish schemes. First, she stripped the larder of food, filling a small wagon and pulling it down the street as she sold off half a ham, a cold roast of beef, grouse from his lordship's Scottish estate, various imported cheeses, and the rock cakes cook was saving for tea time. She turned a particularly impressive profit on the Alpenwalder cheese I had carried home for his lordship, and the Earl felt the loss of this anticipated treat so keenly he confiscated every coin she earned. So, Lady Rose, mindful of her sister's fashionable new gown with beetle wing embroidery, had embarked upon a new plan. One she did not share until we reached Bishop's Folly to find the entire garden throbbing with small greenish orbs, winging their way from leaf to leaf as they solemnly consumed everything in sight.
"Rose," her father said faintly, "what have you done?"
"I was breeding beetles," she said,
standing with her feet astride like a tiny colossus, hands in fists upon her hips.
"I was meant to sell them to dressmakers for pocket money."
The gardener, staring at the carnage, resigned on the spot, and his lordship went after him, good gardeners being difficult to find and even more difficult to keep within the confines of the city.
"A very clever idea,"
Stoker told her kindly. "But pointless," I put in. "The beetles most commonly used for embroidery are wood-boring varieties such as Sternocera equisignata. Unfortunately, these are common rose chafer beetles. You have managed to unleash approximately 1,000 Macrodactylus subspinosis into the garden instead."
"I did not unleash them," she replied darkly. "They unleashed themselves. I had them in a very nice Wardian case until they found a way out."
I gave a start. "A Wardian case? Do you mean you were breeding them in the Belvedere?" After knocking the arm off a particularly rare and elegant caryatid, Lady Rose could be accident-prone, she had been forbidden from the Belvedere unless specifically invited by either Stoker or myself.
"I couldn't exactly breed them in my bedroom," she protested. "I share with Juno, and you know how she is about bugs. It isn't fair either, for she's always blowing things up or mixing solutions that smell like rotten eggs, and no one ever seems to mind."
"She," I returned acidly, "has never destroyed an entire garden. I went to great trouble to secure those particular succulents for Patricia. What is she meant to eat now?" I asked, gesturing towards the Galapagos tortoise that lumbered sadly by. Lady Rose and I had once reached an entente based upon my sharing with her a method to induce a harmless bout of vomiting in one of her brothers who had been particularly annoying, but the fragile bond of understanding had well and truly snapped. I was especially fond of Patricia. Tortoises do not have much personality to speak of, but Patricia was gregarious, as tortoises go. She had recently suffered a disappointment in love, and I had consoled her by planting a row of her favourite succulents, the last pulpy leaf of which fluttered to the ground at my feet, shorn free by the rapacious beetles.
"I didn't mean to," Lady Rose insisted.
Stoker put a hand to her shoulder.
"I know. Come, there are a few violet creams left in my cupboard in the Belvedere, and I've brought home a real find, and I will need help with the uncrating."
"What is it?"
she asked with narrowed eyes. He bent near, pitching his voice to a conspiratorial tone.
"A thylacine."
Her mouth dropped open into a perfect O.
A thylacine? You're joking!
I never joke about Tasmanian tigers. Now, go and wash your hands, because I'll not have my specimen befouled, and we will eat violet creams and admire the fellow.
Lady Rose hurried off, and I stared at him in amazement. How do you do it? She is an unrepentant monster, and yet with you she is a model of obedience and good humour. He cocked his head to one side.
She puts me greatly in mind of what you must have been like as a child.
Heaven forbid! I cried. Stoker merely grinned as he turned away to supervise the unloading of his thylacine. As promised, he gave Lady Rose a lengthy examination of the beast, drawing her attention to its enormous jaw capacity and distinctive ears. Having heard entirely enough of the delights of this particular mammal, I retired to my folly to wash off the grime of travel. I ought to have unpacked, but I could not face the remnants of my ruined net just yet. I left my carpet bag and the box containing the orrery and returned to the Belvedere to enjoy my tea, whilst I opened the mountain of correspondence that had arrived in our absence. Once word had got out about his lordship's intention to open a museum, Stoker and I had become the target for every collector in the kingdom, and further afield. We regularly received letters from as far away as the Americas, describing decrepit collections and offering items for sale. Many of these the Earl dealt with himself, being as acquisitive as his ancestors when it came to unearthing treasures. But dozens of missives were dropped on my desk each week, often with an accompanying enticement in the form of a sample of the collection, and it was my thankless task to sift through them, penning gentle letters of refusal to the least promising, whilst scrutinising the others for any possible delights Lord Rosemoran might have overlooked. He could be entirely single-minded in his pursuit of statuary, and most neglectful of the other arts. He had been known to refuse a first-rate Gainsborough if it meant securing a third-rate Bernini model instead. I was pleased to find this lot contained, amidst the flotsam and jetsam, a fine group of Roman coins from a parson in Northumbria, an enormous fossil from a lady fossil collector in Dorset, and a luscious set of cameos commissioned by a Pamphili Pope. The latter were of particular interest to me, arriving as they did in a scarlet leather box stamped with the papal tiara in faded gilt, along with the Pamphili arms. The accompanying note, from the owner, a papal marquise from Gubbio, explained that the cameos had been a gift from Innocent X to his sister-in-law, Olympia Maidalchini. The formidable Signora Maidalchini had been the power behind the papal throne during the pontificate, and the Pope had showered her with honours, including making her Princess of San Martino. The cameos were a set of 12, carved from the lava of Vesuvius and polished to a high sheen, each representing one of the muses, complete with the corresponding nymph's emblem. From Euterpe's flutes to Melpomene's mask of tragedy, each was beautifully rendered in perfect detail. The cameos had been fitted into settings of fine, granular gold dotted with pearls, a lovely gift for the woman suspected of being the Pope's mistress. I set them at the corner of my desk and listened with half an ear to Lady Rose's questions, most of them surprisingly intelligent, I was forced to admit, as I sorted letters and plucked the occasional beetle out of my tea. At length, George the hallboy came to fetch Lady Rose, as she was very late for tea time, the 1 hour each day his lordship insisted upon spending with all of his offspring. She left, smudged with chocolate and bits of fur and beaming. Stoker was likewise in excellent spirits, and helped himself to a large handful of sandwiches, whilst I gestured to the teapot. "It will want hotting up," I advised him. It has gone quite tepid during the course of your lecture.
I was not lecturing,
he said, pouring himself a cup of the lukewarm beverage.
I was merely pointing out to Lady Rose.
At that point, I stopped listening, knowing Stoker was thoroughly capable of repeating his remarks of the last 2 hours verbatim.
Oh, God, not the bloody Tasmanian tiger again,
came a muffled voice. Stoker and I exchanged startled glances. The voice seemed to be coming from the sarcophagus we used as a buffet. It was of mediocre Greco-Roman design, the mummy long since lost. It could hold an admirable selection of hot dishes as well as stacks of periodicals, but I noticed that it had been swept clean. The usual piles of papers moved to the floor. Furthermore, the assortment of prosthetic limbs, historical examples of wax, wood, and even clockwork metal that usually resided within, had been stacked beneath the trestles upon which it rested. Stoker, I said slowly, I believe we have an intruder.
What sort of intruder would conceal himself inside a mummy case for the better part of 2 hours, only to announce his presence?
Stoker asked.
The sort who did not realise how blasted heavy the lid is and is now trapped,
the voice replied. Stoker bolted to his feet to render aid. The sarcophagus, meant to hold the dead with a minimal amount of decay, would have been sealed when first used in order to protect the mummy from the effects of light and air. Ours, fortunately, had been lightly damaged. The toes had been sawed off at some point, no doubt for ease of packing the unwieldy thing, but this had the benefit of permitting a bit of air to circulate within, although I imagined it would have grown unbearably stuffy after a while. Of course, had I realised who was inside, I might have been inclined to leave him there, but Stoker was already engaged in an heroic rescue. He snatched up a pry bar and wedged the narrow end beneath the lid. One great shove, and it slid open enough to reveal the last face I wanted to see ever again.
Jonathan Hathaway, what in the name of the oozing wounds of Christ are you doing in there?
Chapter 20. The fellow in question blinked at the sudden light.
I say, would you mind terribly helping me out before we begin the Inquisition? And might I trouble you for a bit of food? I've had nothing all day and I am famished.
He said this with the winsome air of a stray pup begging for scraps, and Stoker was instantly moved to oblige. Within a very few minutes, our visitor was ensconced upstairs in the little bolt hole we fondly referred to as the snuggery. He looked thoroughly disreputable, unshaven and dressed in evening clothes that were creased beyond redemption, a deep violet bruise darkening one eye. But he appeared entirely at ease, seemingly viewing the entire experience as some sort of grand adventure. He draped himself on Napoleon's campaign bed, and the dogs had come to investigate him, smelling as he did of the ancient and interesting confines of the sarcophagus. He tolerated their snufflings and licks with good humour until Huxley, the undisputed chieftain of this particular clan, turned away and settled at Stoker's feet, clearly content to let the intruder remain. Having witnessed this imprimatur, the other dogs relaxed. Bettany, the Caucasian sheepdog, took up a post near the stairs, whilst Vespertine sat at my feet, her heavy head resting upon my knee. Newt, the Egyptian hound, settled herself daintily next to our visitor, now and again looking up at him in adoration as he fed her scraps of ham. I had always maintained that Newt was a dreadful judge of character, and her instant affection for our guest confirmed it. He eased into a comfortable position, one hand wrapped around a fresh cup of gently steaming tea the other holding a half-eaten sandwich. It was his fourth. He no sooner finished one than he began the next, giving a gentle moan of satisfaction as he helped himself to cook's best efforts.
"This ham is particularly delectable. Do you know if she smokes it herself?"
he asked brightly. "Stop making polite conversation," I ordered. Stoker gave me a startled look, as well he might. I had been, by turns, either silent or shrewish with our visitor. The fellow gave me a hurt look and finished his sandwich, putting out his hand for another. I jerked the plate just out of reach. "You have had enough. It is time to sing for your supper. What are you doing here?" I demanded. "How did you even know to come to this place? And where is the diamond?" Stoker might have thought my approach unconventional, but the questions were valid, and he turned to the subject of my interrogation with a curious gaze.
"Well?"
Stoker pressed.
"To answer your first question, I saw the address in Charles's correspondence,"
he admitted.
"As to how I came here, when I left the hall, I crossed the moor and caught the milk train at Batley, just before the stop at Shepton Parva. I had heard enough of your situation from Charles to know it was as good a place as any, and better than most, to hide myself." "But why?"
Stoker asked.
"Because I knew I should be suspected of stealing the diamond,"
he said. He sipped at his tea, and the warmth seemed to stiffen his resolve.
"I did not take it, although I cannot expect you to believe that, sir. I give you my word that I did not. And yet, as soon as the diamond was taken, you fled the hall and now are currently hiding out in a sarcophagus? I picked the lock of the Belvedere, thinking this would be a safer place to hide away until you returned, but the girl was always here,"
he replied, in some frustration.
"I did not wish to frighten her, so I hid. But she is a most curious child."
"Lady Rose," I mouthed to Stoker. He nodded.
"But if, as you say, you did not steal the diamond, you must see that fleeing presents evidence of your guilt." "I am aware of that. Yet I will swear upon anything you like that I am innocent. I merely hoped that my prior acquaintance with Miss Speedwell,"
he amended hastily,
"would persuade you both to act on my behalf."
Stoker's brows shot skywards.
"Then you do know him,"
he said, turning to me. I opened my mouth to reply, but he forestalled me.
"We met briefly on our travels. I think she remembers me now, although it was a distant association and long ago,"
he said smoothly. With Stoker's head turned away from him, he gave me a long, deliberate wink. I smoothed my skirts. "No, it will not do. This has been too weighty a burden upon my conscience. I will carry it no longer." Harry's eyes went wide as he looked at Stoker's impressive physique, rather more in evidence than usual, given that he had stripped off waistcoat and jacket along with his neckcloth to work. His sleeves had been rolled up to reveal his sinewy forearms, his collar discarded to bare the strong column of his throat. Harry, I knew from long experience, was assessing Stoker's ability to harm him. He squirmed backwards a little on the campaign bed as Stoker's gaze swung from me to Harry and back again.
"What burden?"
I cleared my throat. "I recognized this man as soon as I saw him at Hathaway Hall, but he is not Jonathan Hathaway. He is the second man Sir Hugo spoke of. This is Harry Spenlove." I paused and drew in a great breath. Stoker canted his head inquiringly. "I did not admit to knowing him, because there was at one time an attachment between us. In fact..."
"For God's sake, don't do it,"
Harry begged, pulling his legs up in front of him in a defensive posture. He upended his empty teacup and held it like a shield. Stoker looked amused.
Sir, I beg you, calm yourself. I am aware that the lady has had previous attachments on her travels. This is the first I have made the acquaintance of, but I hope I may remain a gentleman with regards to liaisons that may have been undertaken well before I even met her.
I am glad to hear you say that, I began.
Veronica!
Harry's voice rose to a shriek. I turned to him. You are the one who said he should know. I am merely agreeing with you. I turned back to Stoker. You are correct. Harry and I formed an attachment whilst we travelled. Stoker held up a quelling hand.
Stop,
he ordered.
I do not need to know anything more.
But I feel obliged to tell you, I protested.
I do not wish to hear it,
he countered.
Veronica, I knew that you had lived a life before our paths crossed, and I am glad of it. No conventional woman would have been prepared to accept me for all that I am,
he said, gesturing vaguely towards his stained clothes, his eye patch, his tattoos.
But I do not crave the specifics. It is enough that at some point you were fond of this fellow, and that attachment clearly faded, or you would not have left him in the past.
Well, she did think I was dead,
Harry put in.
Exactly so,
Stoker replied.
And I've no doubt she grieved for you. But you, sir, are her past. I am her present and future. Your arrival here does not threaten that.
Harry broke into a broad grin.
I quite like this man, Veronica,
he said. Your opinion is entirely immaterial, I said coldly.
Well, I call that unfriendly,
he protested,
and I came here to throw myself on your mercy.
Mercy is not a quality for which I am renowned, I reminded him.
I would like to clear my name,
Harry replied.
I did not steal the diamond.
It is entirely too coincidental that it should have disappeared at the same time you did, I argued.
Not necessarily,
Stoker put in quietly. I turned to him in astonishment. You cannot say you believe him, I began. Stoker shrugged.
I do not know what to believe, but I have a good guess as to why he left Hathaway Hall with such speed.
He turned to Harry.
You were in mortal fear, were you not?
Harry gaped at him.
How did you know that? Simple deduction,
Stoker said.
I took the liberty of examining your room at the hall before we left.
I blinked at him. You did?
I did,
he went on smoothly.
There was money in the washstand drawer, £40 to be exact. A thief would certainly have taken the money along with a change of clothes,
he added, gesturing towards Harry's evening suit. Harry nodded slowly.
I must say, that is a first-rate piece of deduction. I left as if all the hounds of hell were after me, with nothing but my note-case and its 4 shillings in my pocket. You see, I had discovered that the diamond was missing, and I knew I would be suspected.
How? I demanded. He reached into his pocket and retrieved a handkerchief, marked with the initials JH and a pattern of French knots, all worked in dark blue silk. Jonathan's handkerchief? But why should that make a suspect of you? I broke off, understanding at once. Oh, of course. The thief left it with the empty jewel case.
Exactly,
Harry said with a shudder.
You've no idea the fright it gave me, knowing that someone had taken the Eye of the Dawn and meant me to swing for it.
I looked to Stoker. Is jewel thievery still a hanging offence? One forgets. Harry went on.
Does it matter? The intention was that I should be branded a criminal in the eyes of the Hathaway family, most particularly Lady Hathaway. Her good opinion of me would have been entirely destroyed.
I dare say it was not improved by your leaving so precipitously, just as her diamond was stolen. I told him tartly. After all, one must presume you have not an innocent reason for opening her jewel case in the first place. He opened his mouth, then snapped it shut quickly, like a rising carp.
Oh, very well. I did mean to take it, I admit it. I went to Lady Hathaway's dressing room. It was quite late, and she was already abed, snoring like a hound, bless her.
He added, with a fond smile.
But I can move like a cat when necessary, so I crept in and opened the casket.
How?
Stoker inquired.
I have certain skills of long practice,
Harry replied smoothly. This is not his first criminal enterprise, I added.
Such a nasty word, criminal,
Harry mused, rolling his eyes heavenwards so that he looked like one of the younger martyred saints. Such an apt one, I countered. He went on as if I had not spoken.
In any event, I was able to open the casket and I discovered the Eye of the Dawn was missing. The rest of the parure was intact, but the only thing inside the diamond's box was the handkerchief.
He brandished the item in question, and Stoker took it, gazing at it thoughtfully. What are you thinking? I asked. He shook his head.
Nothing precisely. Just that it is a remarkably childish attempt to throw suspicion upon one party in particular. The sort of imagination that might read sensational thrillers.
He looked at Harry.
This was taken from your room?
Or the laundry, Harry said, or I dropped it.
I am forever leaving them lying around. Anyone might have collected it.
And anyone might have disliked you enough to see you implicated in the theft, I said sweetly.
Very true,
he said in a genial tone.
I am accustomed to people deciding to take a sudden dislike to me. It is regrettable, but one cannot help it.
Not if one is engaged in criminal enterprises, I replied.
Might I inquire?
Stoker said politely.
If this is your usual business or merely a hobby?
Harry looked pained.
I have tried to make an honest living, but it is difficult.
It can be,
Stoker agreed.
So,
Harry went on,
I have very often been obliged to return to my less than laudable ways. Fortune has not always been kind to me.
And so you intended to defraud Lady Hathaway of her diamond as your latest criminal enterprise?
Stoker asked.
Things, Harry said coldly, did not go according to plan.
Obviously,
Stoker replied, his gaze resting upon Harry's bruised eye.
After I left the hall in some distress, I met with certain associates of mine who had a vested interest in the diamond. It disappointed them that I was unsuccessful,
Harry said. He prodded the bruise gently with his fingertips.
One of my associates tends to be demonstrative with his fists when he is disappointed.
You were stealing the diamond to order, I said, my understanding suddenly illuminated. It was a conspiracy.
The word conspiracy implies a certain egalitarianism,
Harry corrected.
I was very much operating at the behest of another party.
A party whose attentions I hoped to avoid by leaving the hall as soon as it became apparent I could not fulfill my commission.
You were running away to avoid the thrashing your partners were sure to administer for your failure. I poked his empurpled cheekbone, provoking a shriek. A thrashing they managed to inflict anyway.
My flight from the hall did not go unnoticed,
he said dryly.
I was apprehended as soon as I alighted at the station. They took me to a villa somewhere beyond Hampstead, where they made their feelings about the situation perfectly clear.
And then they let you go?
Stoker asked.
I let myself go. There are only two of them, and the fellow who did this,
he gestured towards his bruises,
left me on my own for a little while, no doubt taking a leisurely dinner to fortify his strength before he came back to finish the job. I did not think it would be a wise strategy to test my hypothesis, so I effected an escape.
And you came here? I said.
You needn't sound so incredulous. I haven't been to London in many years. It would take time to locate friends who might take me in. And, as I said, I had seen your address on the letter Charles had. He showed it around, you know, pleased as punch that a lord had written him. He made each of us ooh and ah over the bloody thing as if it were a holy relic. I remembered the name of the house and thought I might lie low here for a bit, just until I got my nerve back. I never imagined you would be returning so soon, although I must say I am rather glad you did. I was in real danger of suffocating in that monstrosity,
he added with a shudder. The sarcophagus has holes in it, I told him coldly. Your only danger was cramp.
Still, I have had a thoroughly unpleasant time of it, and I want nothing more than to sleep just now, and then eat again, something hot this time. A nice bit of roast beef,
he said, his eyes shimmering with longing.
Do you know how long it has been since I had a nice bit of roast beef? The Hathaways eat far too much lamb. I am heartily sick of it.
Tell us more about these colleagues of yours,
Stoker urged.
A fellow who is free with his fists, you mentioned.
Harry nodded.
Juran, an enormous Swedish fellow whom I have only ever heard communicate in grunts. Swedish is a distinctly unmellifluous tongue. He answers to her.
Her? I inquired. Harry shuddered.
Isabel D'Armas MacGregor,
he said, whispering the name. She is not here, you utter coward, I said.
You do not know. She is capable of anything. Anything. And right now she is put out with me. Very angry indeed. I promised her the Eye of the Dawn, and I cannot deliver.
Why did you promise her the diamond?
Stoker asked. Harry's expression was pained.
There was a little scheme in South America some months back.
He paused thoughtfully.
How much do you know about the Brazilian Empire?
Stoker shrugged and I interjected, mindful of the article I had recently read in the Daily Harbinger. The Emperor, Pedro II, is ailing and elderly. He has only a daughter to succeed him, and power is shifting increasingly towards the coffee growers and the generals in his army. Harry's look was one of admiration.
That is a far sight more than most English bother to know. Yes, the Emperor is failing, and not likely to hold on to his throne for much longer. He worked for many years to abolish slavery in Brazil, a very unpopular position, it must be said. The landowners complained it would destroy the economy, but slavery was ended last year and, in point of fact, the economy has flourished. That ought to have improved the Emperor's popularity, but it has not. He is living out his own obsolescence. All of Brazil turns to the future instead. And that is where Isabel D'Armas MacGregor came in.
He paused, as if to steel himself.
Isabel never believed the end of slavery would damage the economy. In fact, she rather thought Brazil would enjoy a boom of sorts. Expansion in technology and transportation, new investments, that sort of thing. As it happens, she was correct. And if she had had money to invest, she would have made quite a nice packet. But Isabel is not inclined to invest in the normal above-board way. She had a different plan. A railway. From the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Stoker stared in stupefaction.
A trans-Andean railway? Man, it cannot be done.
You know that. I know that. I dare say even these dogs know it,
Harry said, ruffling Newt's elegant head.
But the Brazilian coffee growers can be a bit greedy, particularly when one dangles the possibility of opening new markets to the west via a pretty new railway designed to move their crops to the coast of Chile and beyond.
And they believed her? I asked.
Isabel is a very persuasive woman,
Harry said, with a faraway look in his eye.
She had them convinced, in part because she presented herself, most convincingly, as a lady of royal parentage. She appeared one day in Rio de Janeiro and distributed calling cards, identifying herself as Her Royal Highness the Princess Isabella de Armas de Gonzaga Palmela. Now, an attentive person might have noticed that she cobbled together that title out of Spanish and Italian and Portuguese names. But that was actually quite intentional and rather a stroke of genius. No one could say for certain where she was meant to be from, so it was difficult for anyone to denounce her as an imposter. She presented a letter of credit to the bank in Rio de Janeiro, drawn upon the Bank of Scotland, and settled into the most expensive hotel in town, entertaining lavishly. It was almost convincing. Naturally, the businessmen who would not give a farthing to Isabel de Armas MacGregor were falling over themselves to write cheques to the Princess Isabella. At least, they said they would. When it came to it, they were reluctant to give the money directly to her on the grounds that it was distasteful to do business with a lady, even one of such august rank. So, she decided to find someone to play the part of a respectable man of business, to collect the payments, present them to the bank in exchange for notes, and give them to her in exchange for a percentage of the proceeds.
Enter Harry Spenlove, I guessed.
Indeed.
He smoothed a hand over the stubble at his chin.
I assumed my most toffee-nosed accents and my soberest suit of clothes and took a suite of offices in the most expensive building in the city. Within days they were lining up, bringing me piles of money. I gave the first few lots to Isabel, but there came a day when the wealthiest gentleman, a group of five who were very good friends and making the bulk of the investment, were scheduled to come together to present their monies and receive in exchange their certificates of ownership in the non-existent railway. I took their funds and poured champagne and we all toasted to how rich they were going to be, and they staggered off to have a grand luncheon, to which I was not invited, by the way. And I sat there looking at the pile of cheques. Well, I am not proud of what I did next.
Stoker held up a hand.
We can guess.
Yes, I suppose you can. Isabel, I will admit, did not take things in a sporting fashion.
I expect not, I said. How much did you swindle out of her? Harry murmured a figure, and I felt my eyes go wide. Good heavens! And where is it now?
Gone,
he said cheerfully. Gone where? I asked.
I spent it. How, in the name of seven hells, could you have spent that amount of money?
Stoker demanded. Harry ticked off the items on his fingers.
First-class passage to New York,
the best suite at the Fifth Avenue Hotel, dinner every night at Delmonico's. Then I took a cottage in Providence for the summer. He added, a lovely Italianate-style palazzo I had from a Vanderbilt. Deathly expensive, but worth it. And then there was the yacht.
I held up my hand. Never mind.
And to travel in such circles, I needed the right clothes. Everything from suits to cravat pins and watches. I tried my hand at polo, but I must say I didn't much care for it. I sold the ponies at a loss. I came back to the city for the autumn and stayed through the new year, but America had lost its charm for me by then. New York is a rich man's town, you know. One simply cannot enjoy it in an impoverished state. Besides, by that time I had got word that Isabel was on my trail, and I thought it wise to elude her as it seemed she was holding a grudge.
How do you know that?
Stoker put in. She sent a rather vivid caricature. She is not a bad little artist, although I cannot say I much cared for the subject matter, Harry said with a shudder. So I had a little wander about Canada for a few months to see if I could lose her, but she tracked me to Halifax. I had quite a narrow escape that time. I booked a steerage ticket for the very next steamer to England, which she must have anticipated. As soon as I disembarked at Bristol, they were waiting for me, Isabel and her pet Swede. She made it perfectly apparent that she was still angry, which I told her was not very understanding, and that she ought to take it like a man.
But she isn't a man, I said.
You needn't remind me,
he replied.
The female of the species is indeed more venomous and far more capable of bearing a grudge. She gave her associate, the taciturn and disagreeable Juran, carte blanche to do as he pleased with me. He has a fondness for working with blades.
He broke off with a shudder.
In any event, Juran was preparing to murder me on her orders when I suddenly remembered Jonathan Hathaway and the pretty little collection of jewels his grandmother owns, and I recollected the story he told me of one stone in particular, the Eye of the Dawn. The plot was not a sophisticated one, but I thought of it on the spur of the moment, and for something born of purest desperation, it really wasn't all bad.
He mused.
It was working quite well, too. The jewels were inaccessible. Lady Hathaway kept them in a bank vault in Exeter, and whilst I am proud of my talents, I confess breaking into bank vaults requires skills I do not possess. I had only to wait comfortably at Hathaway Hall until Lady Hathaway decided to send for them. I was racking my brain, trying to hit upon a scheme that would entice her to do precisely that, but there was no need. Charles had already decided to commission a portrait of Mary, and suggested she ought to be painted in the jewels. Rather ironic that it was on my behalf that Lady Hathaway actually brought them out, is it not? In any event, once they were in the house, it should have been the merest child's play to lift the diamond, make my escape, and present it to Isabel with my fervent apologies. That diamond was the price of my head,
he added darkly.
And now it is forfeit.
He gave a great yawn and slipped sideways, the cup tipping gently from his hand. His eyelids drooped, and I raised my hand to slap him smartly, but Stoker caught my wrist. We have not finished our discussion, I protested. I merely meant to rouse him.
Let him sleep,
Stoker said, not dropping my hand.
We have much to discuss.
Chapter 21 Stoker and I repaired to the main floor of the Belvedere, picking our way amidst the costumes and set pieces and leering marionettes. I shall have nightmares, I grumbled, as I set aside a particularly venomous-looking donkey puppet. Stoker perched atop a camel saddle, swinging one booted foot as we talked. "I hardly know where to begin," I said.
"I think we may agree that your taste in paramours has vastly improved,"
he said soberly. "Quite, although in the interest of perfect clarity, I ought to say..." I looked up to find Stoker regarding me with an expression of cool detachment. I had seen his face arranged in precisely the same fashion when he stared at the thylacine scrotal pouch, I realized. It was an indication that he was assessing dispassionately. Whatever confession I had intended to make died upon my lips. I could confide many things, but none of them to that face, I decided.
"Yes?"
The voice was as cool as the expression. "I was merely going to say that I was not aware of Harry's character when first we were acquainted. He is entirely mendacious and not to be trusted." Stoker pondered this.
"Oh, I do not know about that,"
he said casually.
"I am rather a good judge of character. I think he may be relied upon."
"You cannot mean to say that you believe that Banbury tale he just spun. What sort of a villainess is called Isabel? And a Nordic giant with a penchant for blades? It is like something torn from the pages of a sensational novel, and not one of the well-written ones. One of the cheap, pulpy variety available for purchase in provincial train stations." Stoker shrugged one heavy shoulder.
"I find him credible. After all, his bruises are real enough. I am a surgeon,"
he reminded me.
"He cannot have faked those."
"No, but he may have inflicted them," I replied darkly.
"How hard you are upon him,"
Stoker mocked.
"Anyone would think he had broken your heart."
I gaped at him, then took a few calming and restorative breaths to gather my nerves. "I should hope that I am a woman of sufficient character not to bear grudges of anything as insignificant as a failed love affair." He bared his teeth in a smile.
"I am glad to hear it. Now, I think it is perfectly obvious that we must help him."
"Help him?" The words were incredulous and slightly shrieked. One of the dogs howled in protest.
"Help him,"
Stoker repeated firmly.
"One might even consider it our duty. After all, we blundered in and may have overset the plans in motion that could have won him his freedom from this nefarious pair."
"We had nothing to do with the theft of the diamond," I replied.
"But his compatriots do not know that. This is all a muddle at present, and he is in the middle of it, poor lad."
"Poor lad?" I shook my head, wondering if I had possibly struck it without realizing I had done myself an injury. "You do not say that you are in sympathy with him?" Stoker canted his head thoughtfully.
"Well, I have never run afoul of a lady jewel thief, but I have experience with mendacity in the form of a woman."
For one terrible moment, I thought he had discovered the true nature of my attachment to Harry. But then I realized he was speaking of Caroline, his wretched former wife who had cuckolded him and left him for dead in the jungles of Amazonia. I marveled that Stoker and I could have both chosen so poorly in our first attempts at matrimony. It also occurred to me that a fitting revenge upon both of our spouses would be to introduce them to one another and let nature take its course. But that does not reflect well upon my attempts to rise above trivial resentments, so I will draw a veil over this particular notion. Stoker went on.
"I understand how badly one can underestimate the gentler sex. Indeed,
Even referring to them as the gentler sex is a misnomer of the most grotesque variety. When one considers the praying mantis, for example, Mantis religiosa, and how the female of the species will happily bite the head off of her mate after copulation.
I held up a hand. I am perfectly familiar with the practice, I began.
I am certain that you are.
The tone was bland, but I darted him a suspicious look. Before I could inquire, he went on.
Which is to say, I do sympathize with the fellow. He is clearly in fear of his life from a mortal adversary who is both tenacious and clever. She has tracked him, remember, from Brazil to New York, Canada to Bristol, and now to London. We would do well not to underestimate her determination. No, it is quite apparent that Harry Spenlove is in need of our help, if he is to elude this murderous fiend.
I folded my arms over my chest. What do you propose? He shrugged.
It has been a long day, and we are all of us tired. A good night's sleep, and we shall convene a council of war. Amongst the three of us, we should be able to devise a plan that will see Harry cleared of this obligation and set upon his way again.
My mind raced, but I could see from the pugnacious set of his jaw that there was no point in arguing. Very well, I said, with an obliging nod. If you are so persuaded that this is the proper course of action, we will offer him our assistance.
I am glad you see it my way,
he said cordially. However, I added, as if he had not spoken, you must believe me when I say that he is capable of any mischief. The Belvedere is a treasure house of sorts, and none of it belongs to us. We are custodians of Lord Rosmoren's possessions, and, as such, responsible for them. If Harry decided to help himself to something small and valuable to fund his escape, we should be obligated to his lordship.
Agreed,
he said, running a hand over the whisker shadow at his jaw. Suddenly he broke into a mirthless smile.
I have it. We will sleep here, with him.
We will do what?
We will make ourselves comfortable here in the Belvedere. If Harry decides to get up to some mischief, we will certainly hear him and be in a position to stop him. I would offer to mind him on my own, but you know how deeply I sleep, and two pairs of ears are better than one.
He added. An admirable solution, I said, and my voice sounded hollow to my ears. Although I suspect neither of us will enjoy comfortable slumbers, we have only campaign beds to avail ourselves of.
No matter,
he said, dropping to his feet noiselessly.
After all, we can always think of it as an adventure.
Any hope I had of sleeping well was thwarted by the oddness of the situation in which I found myself. Stoker put the matter to Harry with as much tact as possible under the circumstances. It is, after all, no easy thing to insinuate that you intend to sleep near a man because you do not trust him with so much as a hatpin. But Harry, being so often the object of vituperation, was remarkably inured to insult.
My good fellow, think no more of it,
he assured Stoker.
I should do exactly the same in your position. In fact, I will move myself here, to the furthest reaches of this delightful snug, so that in order to reach the stairs I should have to pass both of you.
To demonstrate his resolve, he tucked a narrow mattress under the eaves, as far from any egress as possible. If you do not murder us in our sleep, I muttered, as I arranged a coverlet and pillow on the campaign bed. If either of the men heard me, they gave no sign. I settled into my couch with vespertine, whilst the other dogs collected themselves around Stoker. Apart from Newt, that is. Once more the little Pharaoh hound attached herself to Harry. She had begun life as the pet of a criminal, and I was not entirely surprised at her preference for Harry. She must have had an affection for duplicity. Stoker doused the lamps, and in a short while I found myself the audience for a veritable symphony of snores, snuffles, snorts, and susurrations. Two men and a pack of dogs do not a restful night's sleep make, I reflected, as I lay wakeful long into the night. At length, I was forced to my usual remedy of counting in Persian. I must have drifted off at last, for I found myself dreaming that I was once more in Sumatra, hunting butterflies on the slope of a volcano. They were enormous things, those butterflies, purest white, and with a wingspan wider than my reach. I chased them, but my net was broken, and the volcano was rumbling ominously. I had just followed one to the rim of the crater when a plume of lava jetted skywards with a roar that ended on a thud. Curiously, the thud was realistic enough to jolt me to wakefulness. Beside me, Vespertine lay, head up, ears pricked. I glanced about the snug, deeply shadowed but not entirely black, thanks to the efforts of the moon peering through the skylight above. The other dogs were alert as well, although both men slumbered on. Like any freestanding structure in the midst of a lavish garden, the Belvedere was afflicted with mice, and Stoker and I waged a constant war against their depredations. They cavorted and capered with abandon, and I was well accustomed to their various scribblings and scrabblings. But were they capable of making a proper thud, loud enough to rouse one from sleep? Entirely unlikely. I peered hard into the gloom, straining eyes and ears for some further disturbance, when at last it came, the faint yellow glimmer of a light on the main floor below. An intruder. I eased myself out from beneath the coverlet. I had retired fully dressed, thanks to Harry's presence, but I had left off my boots for the sake of comfort and dared not resume them now. Stocking feet would serve my purpose better, I decided, as I slipped off the narrow bed. Vespertine stirred, but I motioned her back, and she subsided with a reproachful look. She had, in the months since we had come to live together, taken a protective interest in me. But she was a well-trained creature, and although she did not care for being left behind, she obeyed, emitting only the softest of whines in protest. The other dogs, tucked comfortably around Stoker and Harry, merely watched as I picked my way to the staircase, a winding affair of elaborately decorated iron. With no wooden stairs to creak beneath my weight, I stood a good chance of descending without attracting the attention of our visitor, so long as I was cautious. I edged onto the top step, casting an eye over the expanse of the Belvedere's main floor. It was, as ever, a jumble of statuary, Wardian cases, taxidermy mounts, scientific instruments, books, paintings, coin collections, and other assorted items, all made orders of magnitude less orderly by Lord Rosmoren's latest acquisitions, the theatrical props and costumes. Their packing cases had been piled higgledy-piggledy, obstructing my view. But near my desk, I could just espy the nimbus of a single flame, moving erratically. Our intruder was there, then, doubtless rifling my drawers, I reflected in some irritation. I crept down the stairs, edging around the packing cases until I came to a gap. Keeping to the shadow, I studied the figure bent over my desk. It was a man, slender of build and moving with the suppleness of youth. He was dressed, as all good burglars ought to be, in black, a muffling scarf wound about his neck. A cap had been discarded on the desk, and he held a candle high as he shifted a stack of correspondence. The late post that I had merely dropped atop the wooden box I had carried from Hathaway Hall. Putting this aside, he picked up the box. Not an easy feat whilst juggling the candle, and I heard a gentle swear word escape his lips. He turned, and the candle illuminated his face for a moment. I had been correct about his youth. He could not have been more than 20. His features were pleasant, or might have been were they not twisted in a mask of concentration. A drop of candle grease fell to his hand, and he gave a quick gasp of pain, dropping the candle and plunging us into darkness. With the realization that I suddenly had the advantage, I raised my head and gave a short, sharp whistle. Pandemonium erupted. In response to my whistle, the dogs hurtled down the stairs in a thunder of snarls and barks. The intruder gave a small scream and attempted to flee, but I had placed myself between him and the door, stepping out from behind the packing crate, putting my body directly in his path. We collided with extraordinary force, knocking me to the floor and sending the box flying. The intruder must have fallen as well, heavily, from the sound of it, but he was quicker than I, for almost immediately I heard him recover his feet and rush to the door. I thrust myself to my feet to follow, but instantly I was surrounded by dogs and knocked to my knees again. Vespertine was the worst offender, bowling me over and sitting upon my stomach to reassure herself that I was quite all right. She remained there, an immovable force, giant paws resting on either side of my head as she licked my face. "Get off, you daft monster," I ordered, as I attempted to shift her. She moved only slightly, just enough to crush me a little more. The other dogs circled around, setting up a howl until Stoker and Harry appeared, rubbing their eyes.
"What the devil?"
Stoker began. "Intruder!" I gasped. I made a flailing gesture towards the door, but Stoker was already in pursuit. Huxley, the bulldog, alone of all our pets, had given chase, and I was glad at least one of the beasts could be relied upon. Harry stayed behind to pry a reluctant Vespertine off me. I rolled over and whooped air into my lungs until I could breathe freely again, whilst Harry lit a few lamps and tried to settle the rest of the dogs. I was just patting Vespertine. One cannot hold a grudge against dogs, after all, when Stoker returned. He had followed the intruder as he had risen from his bed, shirtless and bare of foot, and he bore the traces of the pursuit when he came back. "He went through the pond and out through the back hedge," I surmised. Stoker nodded. Harry gazed at Stoker in perplexity, then turned to me.
"How do you know that?"
I gestured. "The only part of the property with thorns, mud, and moss is the hedge on the other side of the pond. You will observe the scratches on his torso, just the right height for a hedge. His feet are stained with mud and moss, and there is a lily pad lodged in his trousers." Stoker plucked bits of filth off himself as he spoke.
"He is a fast runner, our visitor. I think the sound of the dogs spooked him, for he made straight for the water, no doubt hoping it would wash away his scent. In any event, he blundered out the other side and crashed through the hedge before climbing the wall."
"And you couldn't catch him up?"
Harry asked. Stoker's nostrils flared in irritation.
"I had an encounter with a tortoise that impeded my progress."
I pointed to the torn knees of his trousers. "Patricia," I informed Harry, "his lordship's Galapagos tortoise, a venerable old thing, but a hazard sometimes. She is very keen on shrubbery and must have been taking a rest under the hedge." Harry shook his head.
"This is the most astonishing and maddening place I think I have ever been."
"And you have only been here a day," I reminded him. I paused, remembering the crash I had heard when the intruder and I collided. The wooden box must have gone flying, for I found it on the other side of the packing crate where I had concealed myself. It had been smashed to bits. I was surveying it mournfully when Stoker and Harry joined me.
"What happened?"
Harry inquired, leaning over the wreckage. "He was attempting to steal this," I said, moving one of the shattered boards aside.
"The Hathaway Orrery?"
Stoker asked. I nodded as I examined the pile of splinters. "A pity. It is quite wrecked," I began. But as I sifted through the broken bits of metal and wood, I saw something glint with unmistakable fire.
"Why on earth would a housebreaker come after an orrery?"
Harry demanded.
"What was so special about it?"
"This," I said simply. I stood up and opened my hand. On my palm, sparking and shimmering, lay the Eye of the Dawn.
"Bloody hell,"
Harry breathed. "Indeed!"